From NPR News, this is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. 5 years ago today, U.S.-led forces began their invasion of Iraq. Operation Iraqi Freedom opened with a full-throttle assault on the ancient capital, Baghdad. Soon after, President Bush declared mission accomplished, but 5 years into this conflict, Iraq is still hemorrhaging from sectarian violence. Almost 4,000 U.S. troops have been killed. Still, President Bush said this morning that the war in Iraq was necessary.
We have fought the enemy on every single battlefront. And so long as terrorist danger remains, the United States of America will continue to fight the enemy wherever it makes its stand.
Voices from many sectors are calling to end the war. Togo West Jr. is one of those voices. He served as Secretary of the U.S. Army under President Clinton. When I spoke with him earlier, Secretary West said America is very divided over what to do next in Iraq.
It's pretty clear now, in terms of all the published reports and the rumblings, that senior officers of the Army and other services in the Pentagon and outside of the theater of conflict, outside Iraq, those senior commanders think it's important to the survival of the Army and to the overall health of our armed forces that a serious drawdown in numbers in Iraq be undertaken. They think the Army simply cannot sustain itself at its present rate of deployment there. That has certainly been suggested by people around Admiral Mullen, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs, and it's certainly behind, one would think, the departure of Admiral Fallon, who, as you know, recently stepped down as the CENTCOM commander, the commander over General Petraeus in Iraq. If you talk to General Petraeus, at least based on his joint press conference with the American ambassador to Iraq and with Vice President Cheney, he who has never served on active duty, the sense is they think that it's essential to the survival of the country's government and therefore to our national interests that we remain there for a substantial period of time. So there are three different parts of the service to talk to. If you talk to military families, those who are serving and living with the daily injury and burdens of the war, then you're faced with something like Douglas MacArthur once said, which is that it is the soldier who has served who most desires peace because he bears the most grievous burdens and wounds of war. They would like to see us out.
You and I spoke at the beginning of 2007, and the surge idea was very much on the table. I asked you about the likelihood of an increase in forces in Iraq that year, and I actually want to play you back some of what you said.
What I'm sensing is that the president is looking for a way to use a discarded term, stay the course, but yet to adjust it. That means he is likely to go for the surge idea. The problem here, of course, as has been identified by several, is that it's not a permanent solution. The fact is that the surge is about a two-year solution, just enough time for the president to complete his term in office, and to leave the problem to be resolved by his successor. I don't say that that's his purpose. It's just that's the way that the numbers work out.
Now, looking back from this moment in time, Secretary West, how do you think the surge is panning out? And do you think that there's any will to sustain the surge past this presidency?
You know, I have to say preliminarily that those must be some of the most feared words to hear. I have what you said earlier on tape, and I'm going to play it.
We didn't mean to have a This Is Your Life moment here.
But I suppose that I would say to you that it seems to have been borne out that way. The surge has been about a two-year solution for the president. At this moment, a year and a half or so. It's borne the results that he hoped for. Everyone is reporting signs of an improved set of circumstances there in Iraq. And frankly, that's good. If the deployment, the surges have contributed to a lessening of violence and a window for the Iraqi politicians to begin to stabilize the country, that would be a good thing. Unfortunately, the other part of the result has also occurred, and that is the problem still exists. This president needs to solve it, but the likelihood is that the intent is to leave that for the next president. As you know, General Petraeus, encouraged by the vice president and I guess others, has already sounded the note that when he reports to Congress, I guess next month or so, he is likely to call for a halt in deployments. That is, there is already beginning to be a drawdown of the surge, but he will call, I think, for a halt once the surge is complete and say, let's wait a month or two before we take out any more. And so we're likely to come into the election with the next president facing the substantial question of delivering either, if it's one of the two Democratic nominees, on their promises to begin taking troops out. I might say there are other commentators who are pointing out that typically with insurgencies of this sort, we are at about the middle of a normal 10-year arc of insurgencies. That is that this won't play out for another 5 years. And if we are have a strategy that says we're going to stay there until the insurgency is defeated, well, that suggests a likelihood of another 5 years minimum.
Secretary West, when you think about the different competing interests that the U.S. alone has in this, to behave honorably, to support the Iraqi people, to ensure that America's strategic interests are protected, to protect the ongoing health of the armed forces as an institution, and just on and on and on. And you think about the precarious nature of some elements of the U.S. economy right now, with oil prices being extremely high, the housing market in turbulence. What will ensure, or what could help ensure, that this war does not actually get lost in a shuffle of priorities over the coming months?
Well, I think that was probably the best summation of all the conflicting pressures and that are making this pot boil that I've heard. I don't think there's a danger that even as we begin to focus more and more of our attention as a nation and as a people, and the attention of our politicians, those who are in power and those who are campaigning for power, on the economic distress of the country, I don't think there's any likelihood that we're going to lose track of the war and of the necessity to make decisions about that war, because to some extent, more and more, the two are becoming inextricably intertwined.
Are you surprised by any of the responses of the American people to this war over time, whether it's the initial support, the initial willingness to believe that Saddam Hussein and al-Qaeda were interrelated, the falling support, and what may now actually be a slight uptick in support for staying longer. Are you surprised at all by how the American people who are at home, civilians, look at the war? And how much influence, in your opinion, having had such an interesting vantage point, does civilian opinion have on the progress of a military action?
We have a nation with some basically conservative impulses. One of those, and it is a conservative impulse, is that when war looms, our populace tends to be reluctant to enter into war and into conflict. But another part of the conservative impulse is to believe that when the chief executive of the United States, representing both the head of government and presumably all the organs that have information to bring to bear on a problem, but also head of state, which is all the majesty and stature of this national community, speaks on an issue and says it is important to do this thing, that even though the American people are not a credulous lot, they want to have answers and information, the inclination is to support our president if he makes a reasonable case, and if the agencies under his command bring reasonable evidence forward. And so public opinion, though wary of a war, wary of a second war, could begin to move that way, understandably. As the war's toll mounts, as there is less and less evidence that the successes that were claimed to be likely, then understandably, the American people begin to doubt the wisdom of the war and to doubt the commitment. If you ask me the underlying belief, I think it is still a belief that this is a war we should not have entered. It is concern of people whom we've tried to help. But at some point, we have to ask the question, are we really helping in a way that will both contribute to their long-term well-being and allow us as a nation to fulfill our part in both for our people and in the community of nations in a realistic fashion?
If you were commander of the forces in Iraq, how soon would you want to see them leave?
I think another 5 years is way too much for us to expect of ourselves, of a nation, of our service members, and of their families. I think that we have probably done what we can there. And as the commander, I might well expect that it is time to begin to prepare for withdrawal, because a withdrawal, a drawdown, is a very difficult thing to implement. By the same token, if you are a commander who has been invested in the mission there and whose belief that success is to not leave the battlefield or the theater unless every single element that you set out as success has been achieved, then understandably even I might find myself reluctant to leave as long as I could fashion arguments from my superiors that said, we're making progress here, we're making progress there. If I were making my decisions from the safety of back here in the United States, from a vantage point that says I can see all the interests that compete for the attention of this country around the world, it might be a clearer decision, and I might be much more inclined to say, as I am, we need to continue planning to depart from that theater.
Secretary West, thank you so much for your time.
It's been a pleasure.
Togo West Jr. is the former Secretary of the U.S. Army. This is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. Barack Obama schools America on race relations, but how did voters take to his message? And Republican nominee John McCain gives his report from the ground in Iraq. For today's political news, we have Dr. Mary Frances Berry. She's a professor of history at the University of Pennsylvania and the former chair of the U.S. Civil Rights Commission. And Robert Trainum, D.C. bureau chief for the Comcast cable network CN8. Hi, folks.
Hi, Farai.
Hello.
So this is the ripple time. I mean, this speech definitely, everyone has an opinion. Probably people who haven't even heard it have an opinion. So let me start with you, Mary. What's your opinion, not just of the speech, but how you think it's going to be received?
Well, first, let me just say, I think the speech is technically a genius category, whoever wrote it and put it together and all that. It has great intellectual appeal. I think people who are intellectuals and people who are thoughtful will remain impressed, and people who really liked Obama before he gave the speech will continue to like him, and he can do no wrong. But I think that people who are a little skeptical or who may not be as intellectual and thoughtful and understand what they mean by having a dialogue about these issues may wonder why he didn't talk about the foreign policy gaffes, if you can call them that, perspectives that Reverend Wright had and did mention in that, and chose just to talk about the race issue, and whether he intends to continue to, although I've heard him say that he doesn't intend to. So I think it'll play very well with the people who really like Obama, and they will be reinforced. I think the people who will wonder if there's something else about him we don't know will continue to ask that question, and we'll just see how it plays out in the polling data.
Robert, some new polls are showing that Senator Obama's lead over Senator Clinton has eroded. Do you think it's as a result of the Jeremiah Wright issue, the issues of his pastor's words?
Yes, it's two reasons. First and foremost, purely from a political standpoint, Farai, the speech had to be given yesterday. And the reason why is because the Obama campaign saw their approval ratings in a free-for-all. This time last week, Barack Obama's approval ratings were about 52%. This time yesterday, they were about 46-47%. So they recognize that their numbers were going down further and further and further the more the media talked about Reverend Wright's comments. The question becomes, and I agree with Mary, as to whether or not Senator Obama was able to reach across the aisle, so to speak, and speak to members out there of the voting bloc that are frightened candidly speaking, by Reverend Wright's comments, that are intimidated by those comments, that are offended by those comments. And I'm not sure Senator Obama was able to do that. Mary is absolutely right. In terms of Senator Obama's base, the people out there that love him, the people that lay palms at his feet in these coliseums, they love the speech. But when you take a look at the average white individual out there who may live in a battleground state, whether it be Michigan or Pennsylvania, which has its primary on April 22nd, or Florida, I'm not exactly sure Senator Obama was able to reach to that person.
Mary, let's talk a little bit about Pennsylvania. There, mm-hmm. you know, in some ways it's similar to Ohio. It definitely, you know, is contiguous to Ohio. But more than just geography, there's the whole question of a state that has black folks, white ethnics, immigrants, this sort of soup of American society, and has a lot of issues around what does it mean to be a working class person in America in this time of economic turbulence. Do you think that in addition to all of the racial issues that Senator Obama has a high mark to hit in Pennsylvania, which is where he gave a speech?
Well, Pennsylvania is unlike Ohio in that the economy isn't quite as bad. Industrialization has taken its toll there, but there's been a great deal of revival, for example, in the Pittsburgh area. And Pennsylvania really is sort of like two states, someone famously said. You've got Philadelphia with its large black population, and then you've got diversity, lots of it everywhere else, and not as many black folk. So I would think that Obama is going to have the same work cut out for him that he had cut out for him in Ohio on the economy and dealing with white males, for example, and dealing with people who are either unemployed or in low-wage jobs, and dealing with all the economic issues. We're in a recession now, I heard an economist say, so I guess I can say it too. We're now in a recession. And so he'll have to deal with all that. And I think the race speech that he gave yesterday doesn't address any of those concerns that people have, and I don't think it will displace any of those concerns. He's likely to end up, if nothing else happens, winning the Philadelphia area, the black vote there, coming short elsewhere in the state, and he's likely to lose, in my opinion, Pennsylvania.
Fry, may I chime in?
Please.
You know, I'm from Pennsylvania, and having worked on certain or several campaigns in Pennsylvania, I know something about that state. You know, with 12 million people in the state, Mary's absolutely right. You know, you have Philadelphia and Pittsburgh, and you have Alabama in the middle, as James Carville said back in 1994. And what's interesting about Pennsylvania is that it is a huge manufacturing state, a very blue-collar state. We like to say in Pennsylvania, we still make things in Pennsylvania. And unlike Ohio, you know, as Mary said before, the economy is humming along a little bit at a better clip than in Ohio, but specifically to Pennsylvania and Senator Obama. Senator Obama most likely will win Philadelphia and the collar counties just outside of Philadelphia. There are about 200,000 to 300,000 African Americans in the city of Philadelphia alone, or if not more. And in fact, they probably will go with Senator Obama. The real question is whether or not he is able to pick up some cities such as Erie, Pittsburgh, Scranton, Altoona, and Johnstown. And I don't think that's likely. I think Senator Clinton probably will win the state. She most likely will win the state probably by 3 or 4 points. And if, in fact, she does win Pennsylvania, which has about 126 delegates, she is back in this game big time.
Well, the only place where the right thing may play in is on some of the university and college campuses where students who are Obama students and are working very hard have some serious questions about some of the things he said on foreign policy, worrying about his commitment to the state of Israel, for example, and the whole Middle East thing. If any of that has any impact, it may do something to sort of dampen his expected college age youth vote, which might give Clinton a larger margin.
I want to move on to Senator Hillary Clinton. She gave her own speech, this one on the Iraq War. This was yesterday. Let's listen to what she had to say.
The mistakes in Iraq are not the responsibility of our men and women in uniform, but of their commander-in-chief. From the decision to rush to war without allowing the weapons inspectors to finish their work, to the failure to send enough troops and provide proper equipment for them, to the denial of the existence of a rising insurgency and the failure to adjust the military strategy.
As you know, I mean, this is the fifth anniversary of the war.
Yes.
What I'm wondering, I'll go to you first, Mary, and then Robert. Is Senator Clinton at anything of a disadvantage with voters who are opposed to the war? You know, that's one of the distinctions that Senator Obama has tried to make, that she supported it, I didn't. Does that matter to Democratic voters? And then is this really an advantage for the Democrats in the fall, that public opinion is generally against the war?
There has been an erosion in the number of people who are opposed to Senator Clinton because of the war issue, as her position has come closer to that of Obama. And she talks, too, about getting troops out within 60 days, although she walks a very fine line. Also, Senator Obama's point he keeps making about the speech that he made and showed good judgment has been somewhat eroded by all the talk about his judgment around the right issue. And American public opinion on the war has become less negative than it was before, given the surge that has taken place and the arguments about is it successful or not. And you can argue all day long that it really isn't, because the politics haven't changed, but in terms of the level of violence there. So I think that Clinton still has possibly to gain support from people without worrying too much about the war, except in some quarters. And she's probably better positioned than Obama is on the war issue for a general election campaign against McCain. Of course, she'd have to get nominated first. That's important. But she's better positioned than he is, and she's always been better positioned than he has been on that question.
You know, Farai, I have to take issue with the soundbite that you played of Senator Clinton yesterday. And the reason why is because what she said was very eloquent, however, somewhat disingenuous. Here's why. Not only did she vote for authorization of the war 5 years ago, but she also serves on the Armed Services Committee. And if, in fact, she felt very strongly about the issues of malnourishment with the troops as it relates to equipment and so forth, she had a very, or she does, so currently still has, a very powerful position on the Armed Services Committee to make hay about that. And if, in fact, she is doing that now, that's fabulous. But she should have done it over the past 5 years when she had the position to do so.
Well, Robert, you should be aware, and I just happen to know this because I checked it before we came over, she has been one of the leaders on the committee for trying to get improvement in the conditions for the troops, their material support, all these issues about whether they had the right vests or the right Humvees or whatever these military things are. She's been a leader on that. I think it's because she's got a whole bunch of troops out of Fort Drum up in New York. That's a New York state issue, not necessarily for the presidential race. So on that, she's talked about that. But as for voting for the war, too, I think in all fairness, we should say that most of the Democrats voted for the war. I mean, every time we say that, it's as if she, and Obama, of course, was not in the Senate at the time. So I don't think she gets home free, and many of the people who are anti-war and that's the number one issue for them will still be opposed to her, and they will be opposed to her in Pennsylvania and everywhere else. But I do think her record is at best is mixed at worst.
Well, let me just reintroduce what we're doing for anyone who is just tuning in. This is NPR's News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. You're hearing from Mary Frances Berry, professor of history at the University of Pennsylvania, former chair of the U.S. Civil Rights Commission, Robert Trainum, D.C. bureau chief for the Comcast cable network, CNN. And we are talking what else? Politics, talking Iraq. And let's talk a little bit about John McCain. He's been in the Middle East this week. He says the surge is working. The U.S. military has made significant progress. He also said that, quote, Al-Qaeda is going back into Iran and is receiving training. And, you know, then he basically said, no, wait, you know, that's not really what I meant to say. You know, let me start with you, Robert. Was that a significant blunder or just something in passing? He is, of course, the man who has sung Bomb Iran to the tune of Barbara Ann. But
Yes, to answer your question, it is a pretty significant gaffe. There's no question about it. We should also mention that as soon as he said those words, his Democrat/independent colleague, Senator Joseph Lieberman from Connecticut, whispered in his ear, and he very quickly, changed his tune. Look, Senator McCain has spent his whole life in foreign policy. There's no question about it. I don't think anyone would question his foreign policy credentials. He made a mistake. He admitted the mistake and very quickly moved on for it. But I think this is a bigger issue for I, and that is that here you have here at home, the Democrats literally infighting over race, over superdelegates, over the convention, about, you know, the recount in Michigan or in Florida. I mean, the list just goes on and on and on. And here you have the Republican nominee who has already been coronated, so to speak, traveling around the world to the Middle East, meeting with foreign leaders, meeting with the President of the United States, again, highlighting all of his foreign policy credentials, looking very presidential, raising a lot of money. This is John McCain's dream right now. And candidly speaking, this is the political operative's dream on the Republican side, because the contrast could not be any better.
And I think Robert is exactly right. The Democrats, some days I think Democrats are deliberately trying to shoot themselves in the foot, that somehow they have this wish that it looks like we're going to win. What could we do to keep from winning? Whether it's Florida and Michigan and worrying about, talking about people, operatives, people who are higher up who make decisions, making bad ones and other people suffering. You've got all those people who decided to have the primary in Florida. It wasn't the little people who decided that. All they did was to go out and vote. And now you have all these folks saying, well, that's just too bad. They'll be disenfranchised. I even heard the Democrats say, we don't need them in November.
Let me jump in because this is something that really we don't have a lot of time to discuss it, but just what the heck is going to happen? You know, it looks as if there's not going to be a revote in Florida. So either Hillary Clinton is going to get the lion's share of you know, if they seat the delegates, although there's, you know, arguments about whether or not it was really a fair fight, given right. that it was pushed up.
So her name was only on the ballot.
Yeah, exactly.
That's Michigan, yes.
Mm-hmm. Well, no. Yes, in Florida, she was not the only person on the ballot, correct?
Everybody was on the ballot.
Everyone was on the ballot, but she won, and there's some questions, I think, about whether or not a revote would actually favor Obama, but it doesn't look like it's going to happen. Is that a good or a bad thing? What are they going to do, the party?
I think the Obama people are making a mistake by not coming out very strongly in favor of having a revote. If they had a revote, they'd probably win, in my opinion. But that's just my opinion. But they're, you know, behind the scenes making noises about, you know, why not have don't have a revote. I guess they don't want to risk the possibility that a few more delegates might dribble in. But when you start disenfranchising people, and you can call it anything you want to call it because of some decisions higher ups made, you really do leave a lot of people angry. You leave a lot of people with a bad taste in their mouth. They're setting themselves up so that their convention can be, you know, as we've said, a bloodbath.
As messy as possible.
It's going to be one
big circus. America can watch it. You know,
all right.
That's what they're doing.
You know, Fry, very quickly, you know, 8 years ago, didn't we talk about this? I mean, this is like deja vu all over again. But what's interesting about this is that the Republicans at that time did not want a recount. The Democrats wanted a recount. And fast forward to 2008 now, Barack Obama does not want a recount. I mean, the whole thing is just one big circus that the Democrats are literally chasing their tails around. And here you have John McCain literally traveling around the country being the global statesman.
Yeah. All right. Well, one final question very quickly. Do you think that the Democratic Party leader, and I'm going to have to throw this to you, Mary, very quickly. Do you think that the Democratic Party leaders will step in and unify some of what's going on?
I have no idea. When Roger Wilkins and I wrote to Howard Dean several weeks ago about the Florida-Michigan thing, you know, all I got back was mouthings about, oh, well, we'll work it out before the convention. All I've seen him do on TV, he hasn't shown any real leadership on this issue. So I don't know why he doesn't step up. They said that the revote in Michigan would be okay, the DNC has, but he ought to push that. I don't think they will. I think that what we're headed for is a big mess, and it'll just drag on, and people will tell themselves, oh, well, it'll work itself out in the end, and it won't.
All right. On that note, cheerful note, question mark, Mary and Robert, thanks so much.
Thanks, exclamation point.
Exactly. That was Mary Frances Berry, a professor of history at the University of Pennsylvania and the former chair of the U.S. Civil Rights Commission, and Robert Trainum, Washington, D.C. bureau chief for the Comcast cable network CN8. Both joined us from our studios in Washington, D.C. I'm Farai Chidea, and this is News and Notes. The reaction to Barack Obama's speech on race and politics was instant and intense. Our web producer, Jeffrey Bennett, is back to give us a read on the reaction. Hey, Jeff.
Hey, Farai.
So what have people been saying on the blog about the Obama speech?
Yeah, well, the responses range from people who were impressed by the speech to those who liked what he had to say but were afraid that he'd be now painted as the black candidate. So here's a sampling. This from Glenn Anderson. I'm 40 years old, and this was one of the most moving and inspiring speeches I've ever heard. My parents have Malcolm and Martin to speak of when talking about their contemporaries. I now have Barack Obama. Bill M. wrote, "Bad timing. With the news cycle focusing on the bottom falling out of the economy, this speech on race seems mildly out of touch with the real issues affecting Americans." And D. from Los Angeles wrote, "Now that he's addressed the race issue, will it change perceptions of Obama? It was a powerful speech, but I believe there are Americans who will never believe that a black man is capable of loving this country."
So how's the election playing out in the larger blogosphere?
Well, bloggers, as we know, are often the first to respond to the day's news. And according to Nielsen's Blog Pulse Index, over the past month, bloggers have been focusing most on Barack Obama, then Hillary Clinton and John McCain, in that order. So on March 5th, the day after Hillary won the Texas and Ohio primaries, the number of blog posts about her doubled. And since this Jeremiah Wright controversy broke, the number of blog posts about Barack Obama have nearly tripled those of Senator Clinton. And John McCain's trip to Iraq hasn't delivered the kind of attention he'd like, at least not from bloggers. He's still trailing behind both Democrats in terms of blog trends.
So what else can folks find online from us this week?
Well, NPR.org this week launched a new initiative called Get My Vote. So we're interested in the concerns and convictions that are motivating people this election season. And folks can upload video, text, or audio commentaries. And there's more about how to do that on the front page of our blog. And we're still on Facebook. And people can get news and notes in their inbox each day by signing up for our newsletter. So they should do that as well.
All right. Well, Jeff, thanks again.
Thank you.
Jeffrey Bennett is the web producer for News and Notes, and he joined me from our studios at NPR West. On our bloggers' roundtable, where are we 5 years after the Iraq invasion? The Detroit City Council asks Mayor Kwame Kilpatrick to resign, and New York Governor David Paterson and his wife Michelle publicly admit that they stepped out on each other. With us today, Valencia Rohner. She runs the blog Diary of a Content Black Woman and hosts the Content Black Woman show on Blog Talk Radio. Also, LN Rock, otherwise known as the African-American Political Pundit. He's also a member of the Afrosphere Bloggers Group and author and DJ Richard Graves, who writes the blog DJ Black Adam. Welcome, folks.
Hi, Farai.
Hello.
So there's plenty to talk about. Let's start with Iraq. We've been talking throughout the show about the fifth anniversary. Today's the fifth anniversary of the U.S.-led invasion of Iraq. Richard, let me start with you. You served in the Marine Corps during the first Persian Gulf War. Did you support going into Iraq 5 years ago?
Well, I actually did support it. I supported it because of what Colin Powell had to say primarily, plus the fact that I was aware of Saddam Hussein's human rights record, so I figured that something had to be done about him sooner than later. And I, most importantly, though, I was believing that there was weapons of mass destruction there and that perhaps there was a link to al-Qaeda from with Saddam Hussein. But once I found out that most of that was untrue, I, like most Americans, was totally against our presence in Iraq right now. However, I think we're stuck, though.
When you say, "I think we're stuck," does that mean 5 years, 10 years, 100 years? What does "I think we're stuck" mean to
you?
Well,
I'm under the impression, I'm under the position that the only thing that's going to end the conflict there is partitioning of the country. I agree with Senator Biden with that. And until that happens, we're going to be stuck there keeping those sides apart. Because honestly, politically, there is no way for us to withdraw completely without setting up some type of mandate there in order to keep them from going to the inevitable civil war. I mean, I think that it's inevitable. If we were to withdraw right now completely, there would be a civil war. The question then comes to, is that our concern or should that be our business? And I think it is our concern simply because we broke it. I mean, when you break something, I think you should fix it. I think we would look even worse to the world if we just pulled out and let that whole area go into chaos, plus not to mention how it would destabilize the whole region over there. We can't allow that to happen, regardless of what the Democrats or the Republicans are saying. We cannot allow that to happen. So what we're going to end up doing is staying there until the country is partitioned. And when someone wakes up and decides that's what they're going to do, until that happens, we're going to be stuck there.
Valencia, you heard what Richard just said, and then earlier in the show we heard from Togo West, former Secretary of the Army under President Clinton. He said, "We've probably done all that we can, even though the insurgency will continue, it's time to get out." Do you agree with Secretary West?
I do agree. It is time to get out. But I, like Richard, initially was kind of in support of the war initially because of Colin Powell. He had a credibility that I trusted and believed in and a record. And we later found out that basically he was kind of pushed into kind of being in support of the situation. And now, and he said, if you break it, you fix it. And so we've broken it, but it doesn't look like we're going to be able to fix it. And so now we have a lot of lost lives. Bush gave his report on it in light of the anniversary. And it just is very frustrating because he appears to be just so delusional in terms of what the real impact is. And just, I would expect better leadership out of my president.
Ellen, there are protests going on around the country, you know, some of them huge, but protests that occurred before the war didn't stop the war. If you're against the war, are protests really useful today? If Americans, certainly some Americans do want to stop the war, how would you go about communicating that?
Well, I think that the protests are right on time. In fact, in getting to the studio here, I was blocked off by protests for about an hour just to get here. It was powerful. It's a powerful protest. It's about time. 5 years later, billions of dollars spent each month, going on possibly $2 or $3 trillion over a 10-year period. Togo West is right. And what are we supposed to be now? The gatekeepers of what is right and wrong in America, in the world. We have to stop at some point. And the point is now. We need to get out. We need to get out as soon as practical. We just have to do it. We have to withdraw. I'm not in agreement with those that would say, well, we got to stay for 100 years or 10 years or 15 years. The fact that folks are willing to demonstrate and say, like Code Pink, we have to stop this madness. I mean, when does the madness stop?
I want to point out that you're in Washington, D.C., and that's where the protests around you are, and there are ones all over the country. But let's go back to this issue of partitioning. Ellen, I want to ask you about what Richard brought up, which is the idea of doing something somewhat similar to the former Yugoslavia and creating territories, you know, the Kurds, the Sunnis, the Shia. Is that America's job, and B, would it work?
It's not America's job, and I'm not sure if it'd work or not, but it's up to the Iraqis to make a decision on where they want to go in terms of their country. If they want to create separate states, as an example, separate territories, it should not be an authority. You know how we came in and got rid of the Baathists and got rid of all the military and just said, let's start from scratch, let's bomb people into submission. Well, now that we have bombed them into submission, there's a point where you have to say, guess what? We have to get out of here. We cannot do any better. In fact, we'll probably do worse. I'm with Togo on this.
Richard?
Well, I kind of disagree with you there. I mean, I do realize that it is up to the Iraqi people, but it was up to the Iraqi people before we went in the first time. And since we did not allow the evolution to take course where the Shiites eventually tried to, you know, get rid of the Baath party, what we have done, we've gone in there, we bombed the country, and we didn't fail in going in and invading and occupying the country. We failed in setting up government and in dealing with, administrating the country. So we did that completely wrong. We didn't go in, like Colin Powell had said, with overwhelming force, nor did we go in looking to try to be able to govern a country, kind of let it be a free-for-all. Now you have a situation that if we do just pull out all willy-nilly, then the Iranians are going to come in there, and that's a whole different problem. Ultimately, I'm sure to everybody, as a veteran, as a Marine, I want to see all the Marines come home. But unfortunately, we've started something, and we're going to have to finish it. And I'm not saying it like a Republican, saying we got to stay there for 100
years.
Yeah,
you are.
We got to be real about it. Well, I'm not a Republican, so I'm not saying it like a Republican. But I'm saying it as realistically. I'm a realist. Realistically, we have to make sure that we leave that place as stable as possible, or whether you guys like it or not, we'll be right back there again, because the United States is the United States. We are part of NATO, and if that part of the world goes psycho, we'll be the ones back there again, and it'll be a whole lot harder to go back there and even attempt to try to impose anything after the fact.
Valencia, people are paying attention to this today, and I think, you know, obviously it's on the minds of Americans, but right now, the incredible volume of things that's happening with the economy is really, from what I can tell, the foremost things on people's minds. And so in that case, will Iraq just sort of continue without enough discussion because people have their minds on other issues?
I think that it will continue because it has an impact, especially if people's families are associated or you know someone whose family is associated and haven't been in the war. But the economy is a real issue, and people are losing their homes at record rates. And the Federal Reserve Board dropped the interest rate, you know, yesterday. But is it too little, too late? I mean, we're dealing with these issues, and so while the war continues to be an issue, and we will have people speak out against it, you do risk things like the protests that are taking place to have less an impact because people are so concerned about their own personal welfare.
I want to move us on to another topic. It has a little bit more to do with personal welfare, but not in a particularly good sense. We're talking about Detroit. Mayor Kwame Kilpatrick, the Detroit City Council asked him to resign yesterday because of basically him lying under oath about an alleged affair. Kilpatrick responded by saying, quote, "You take a whole day to discuss an issue like this. My reaction is this is over. It has no effect. It's not binding. Let's get back to work." He basically said that he has no intention of stepping down. Valencia, you're blogging about this. What's going on?
I think, like Bush, he's delusional. I mean, he just doesn't get it. He has had an impact on the city of Detroit in a way. This morning, I visited the Channel 7 news report, Detroit's news report, and it indicated that 96% of the people who voted want him to step down. I mean, so he needs to understand what his actions have done to the office, and the office is bigger than he is, and I think he just needs to step down because of the demand, because otherwise it's going to distract from the other important issues. I mean, Detroit's in a terrible economic situation, and it's going to be just difficult to deal with that and a host of other issues unless he just humbles himself and step aside, because it's going to get worse before it can get better.
Well, you know, there's actually something else going on. The New York Governor David Patterson held a news conference. He said that he and his wife Michelle had extramarital affairs during a rough patch in their marriage. With his wife by his side, he stressed that he didn't break the law. So it's kind of like Cheaters Daily or something. Ellen, what's going on?
Wow, I was amazed at that story. Not the fact that people cheat and relationships go south for a moment. And in fact, in many ways, I respect him for coming out and saying it before others found out. In fact, that's probably it. It was one of those cover your butt situations with him, because the former governor who just left just a couple of days ago had to cover his butt. So I guess it's a situation where he didn't want to get caught up in the same situation and, in fact, get turned out like the previous governor did.
Richard, do you think that this is a day that will go down in infamy for, you know, politicians, just like, you know, yet another day of confessions? Or was this just a shrewd, smart political move?
I think it was a very smart political move. If he hadn't have come out with it, I'm sure the Republicans are wanting to get the governor's position in New York State, and it would have been exposed in the wrong way, and it would have been controversialized, and it would just been utilized as a tool to try to remove a Democrat from the governor's seat in that state. So he was very smart in getting it out ahead of time. He did it on his own terms as opposed to waiting for somebody to catch him with his pants down.
You know, some people have said, yeah, I mean, literally and figuratively, some people have said, oh, this is a bad day for black people. You know, once again, we're in the news for cheating. I think that Elliot Spitzer may have taken some of the sting off of that. But, you know, there is this movement, Valencia, where it's like, if one black person does bad, it's on all of us. I mean, is there any sense that this is something that, you know, is a shame, or is this just politics as usual?
You know, quite frankly, I think it's politics as usual. And to your point, Spitzer's situation has taken the stink off. I mean, to wake up on the other day and, you know, my daughter says, just TMI, too much information. And in light of all this, now the New Jersey New Jersey's former governor's wife's driver came out and said that they were involved in a threesome. I mean, can our children not watch the news to complete current events reports now? I mean, so
obviously not.
So I don't take it as a black issue because it seems like everybody has got more than enough skeletal bones in their closet, it seems like.
And Ellen, what do you see ahead for Patterson? That this is just done and over, as opposed to Kwame Kilpatrick, where it's definitely not done and definitely not over the debate, I mean?
I would say that Kwame is done, and this is done for Patterson as well. I'm talking about done in the sense that I don't think anybody's going to make any noise about it.
So the Patterson scandal is over, but Kwame
I think it's over.
Yeah.
But Kwame, he should learn from Spitzer and just go ahead and resign.
All right. Lady, gentlemen, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We've been talking with author and DJ Richard Graves. He writes the blog DJ Black Adam. He was at member station WBEZ in Chicago. LN Rock, otherwise known as the African-American political pundit. He was at NPR headquarters in Washington, D.C. And Valencia Rohner of the blog Diary of a Content Black Woman. She was with me here at our NPR West studios. And you can find links to their blogs and ours at nprnewsandnotes.org.